Hello, folks. It's Archery, and you are listening to Why We Do the Work. I would like to thank Beyond Toxics for sponsoring this podcast. You can also meet the rest of the team and check out all what's happening on the Beyond Toxics website at beyondtoxics.org. And I also would, of course, like to thank my podcast partner, Crystal. Hi, Crystal. You can also find me at AAB at beyondtoxics.org. Reach out to me anytime. I would love to talk to you. Last episode, we had Mason here for a two-parter. As a reminder, Mason is the BT, Beyond Toxics, ArcGIS Spatial Data Coordinator. He was here last episode. We had a two-parter, and we were talking about gas stations, that hot, hot topic that everybody's talking about. We wanted to talk about that, let everybody know what's happening locally in Eugene, and what City Council is saying about it. So thank you, Mason, for being on the show to talk about gas stations with me. So we're going to start here. We're going to talk about some hydrogen today with Caleb Lay. I met Caleb back in November of 2023 at a retreat hosted by OJTA. And OJTA is Oregon Just Transition Alliance. OJTA is one of our partner EJ organizations. Shout out to the OJTA team, Jolie Boa, Anna Molina, and Allie Harris. You can say hey to them and learn about their work and what they do as an organization at ojta.org. Before I have Caleb introduce himself, I want to give a bit of background for our conversation. Back in October of 2022, a utility company applied to implement a $9.8 million project that would blend 5 to 10% hydrogen by volume into Eugene's gas distribution system in the Bethel neighborhood. And if you guys remember, Bethel neighborhood is West Eugene. That's what this podcast really talks about. They were trying to do a blending project in the Bethel neighborhood. This project would build an equalizer to produce the hydrogen using electricity and water purchased by the Eugene Water and Electricity Board. After the equalizer is built, the company would test pushing out the blended hydrogen in portions of the Bethel neighborhood in West Eugene. But the power of community and community-based organizations was able to put a halt to that project in November of 2022. To quote Beyond Toxics Executive Director Lisa Arkin, this should be a lesson for all toxic polluters. The West Eugene community is not a sacrifice zone. This project was absolutely unacceptable, and its withdrawal is a testament to the power of community opposition. Thanks, Lisa. And again, as a reminder, this is why this podcast exists, is because of West Eugene. That area of town is known to have higher rates of cancer and asthma due to the close proximity of residential and industrial facilities. The media stated that the experimental pilot project proposed would have mixed hydrogen gas into the fossil gas that is delivered to the homes in the Eugene Bethel neighborhood. This is a working class community where over 90% of the residents are considered low income and with a higher percentage of communities of color compared to the rest of the city. In their petition opposing the project, environmental and social justice groups expressed concern over the siting of the project in a community that is already disproportionately burdened by air pollution. Burning hydrogen generates nitrous oxide pollution, a lung-damaging pollutant that contributes to the formation of the ozone. So I wanted to stage that conversation that I'm going to have with Caleb today, because we haven't had a chance to discuss hydrogen on this show, but it's also a hot, hot topic. And I think it's an important and interesting topic to discuss, especially since this hydrogen conversation was set to take place in West Eugene. Hi, Caleb.
Hi, Audrey. Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here on this podcast.
Yeah, I'm glad you're here too, Caleb. This conversation is going to be exciting and interesting. I really loved how animated you were at the retreat. That's one of the reasons that when I was watching your show, I kept calling it a show because you're just so entertaining and it was so fun to watch you do this presentation on such a really, really high level and complicated conversation. So Caleb, tell us about your organization a little bit.
Yeah, so I actually got a promotion since the last time we talked, forgot to mention, but I'm now the Director of Policy and Research for Oregon Rural Action. We're a really small 501c3 nonprofit, and we do community organizing and policy work up in Northeast and North Central Oregon, really engaged in issues around groundwater contamination and building climate resilience. So our plates are a little full, but that's what we have allies and friends for, right?
Yeah. Congratulations on your promotion, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
That's awesome. So, Caleb, I like to research people before I get on the show.
Oh, no.
Yes, I do. I like to get on the Google and I like to see who I'm talking to and some of the interesting things that they have done in their lives. And first of all, I don't know why I thought you had an 8-year-old. You told a joke at the retreat and I thought you said my 8-year-old. So I'm sorry that I was like, oh, when I sent you an email, sorry about being like, oh, I hope your 8-year-old liked Christmas. Sorry about that.
No worries. I do have a 5-year-old blue tick hound and he keeps me equally as busy as an 8-year-old would.
Oh man. So Caleb, I read that your family has lived in Union County for over 5 generations. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So actually my great-grandpa Joseph Coleman Lay, he came over on the Oregon Trail, settled in an area called Medical Springs, and my family has been there ever since. We do a lot of tree plantings these days. We're trying to reintroduce beavers. I actually put up a bunch of birdhouses this last weekend, try and bring in more woodpeckers to fight those pesky pine beetles that keep coming in. So it's one of my favorite places in the world. Really love it. And it's sort of one of the things I think that brought me around to environmental justice work in the first place.
Nice. It's beautiful out there, huh?
Oh, it's absolutely stunning. I wouldn't trade it for anywhere in the world.
I used to live in Klamath Falls for a few years. And I don't know what I was doing in Klamath Falls for fun, besides I went to beauty school there, which I think I liked that I went to beauty school in Klamath Falls because I would have been a little bit distracted around friends in Eugene when I was living there. But there wasn't even a mall in Klamath Falls. We didn't tell my oldest daughter that there wasn't a mall till we were driving there. And I was like, you know, Peyton, there's not even a mall. And she was like, what? So she used to go to Walmart to hang out with her friend. Like they would go to Walmart like it was the mall.
Oh, all through high school. Yeah, that was the hangout place for sure.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
She would be like, Mom, can I go to Walmart? And I was like, why do you want to go to Walmart? Yeah. Oh, just to try on clothes and hang out.
Hey, don't sell it short. It can be fun, especially for a 16-year-old. So.
Yeah, and especially probably during Halloween. You know, you can mess around with all those costumes and masks and stuff. She's got tons of pictures trying on masks. Yeah. And
play on the scooters.
All that. Pictures now that would be blackmail photos. that's what I would use them now for, blackmail. But when I was researching you, Caleb, I found something really interesting. What's up with that murder that you wrote about?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Back in my journalist days.
Yeah.
I like to say that I went into print media because I made a lot of mistakes in college. But I actually worked for my hometown newspaper for a while here in LeGrand and covered everything from double murder to another newspaper. I covered some bomb sniffing robots that were supposed to take care of ordnance washing up on the beaches of Hawaii.
Wait a minute, robots on the what?
Yeah, it was super fascinating. So I got to cover this bomb squad they were putting together on the island of Kauai, and when I was working for the newspaper there, and they had just gotten a bomb sniffing robot, and they were doing some trainings on how to like clear a building, but I got to talking to them and they said one of the biggest problems that they have and need the robot for was all this World War II ordnance would just wash up on the beach and tourists would find it, and they needed the robot to deal with it safely. It was fascinating, and like just the way that all that history is still playing out there, it was amazing.
Wow. See, you're interesting. That's why I want to be on the show.
Robot. Don't accuse me of that. I don't know if I can back it up.
You can. You can, and you do.
Well, thank you. You do.
So a little bit of a side note here. This work can put us in dangerous situations sometimes. An example of that is one of Caleb's teammates, Rafael Romero, had some vandalism happen to his vehicle. Do you want to talk a little bit about that, Caleb, and set the stage on how dangerous this job can be for us sometimes?
This is something that's really important for us to talk about as, you know, people who work in community organizing and in the work we do, we're often trying to speak truth to power and also challenge power. And power doesn't always like that. But so back in November, you know, a lot of the work we do at ORA is organizing around groundwater contamination in the Lower Umatilla Basin. And part of what we do to try and spur change and to bring, you know, power with good intentions in is we host officials and legislators in the area. We take them on a tour and we have them meet directly with community members who are impacted by that contamination. So back in November, we were hosting three legislators from the state legislative BIPOC caucus, Black, Indigenous, and People of Color. And one of the things we were doing is taking them on a tour of the area, see the pollution, see the infrastructure and all the engineering that goes into the pollution. And the last place we stop is always the home of one of our other community organizers in Boardman. She has a contaminated well, and it's actually been on the Department of Environmental Quality or DEQ monitoring well network for many, many years. She just learned about it a few years back that the water in her home was contaminated.
Wow.
Yeah. So we stop there, and that's usually our last stop, sort of bring everything home with the human impact, right? And we were there for a while with the legislators, and almost immediately after we left to go to the larger community meeting and the question and answer segment, we got a call that Raphael's truck was in flames, and it had been parked there all day, hadn't been running. He had some big magnets on the side, some big campaign magnets saying, "Did get your water tested, it might be contaminated," that sort of thing. And it was really devastating. The vehicle was totaled. There was a really strong smell of turpentine at the scene, and there were things that had been inside the vehicle scattered all over the place. And first responders described it as definitely arson. Those are the words they used.
Definitely.
Yeah. So, you know, in our mind, there's no question about it. This was an act of violence against us for the work we do. And it's heartbreaking and traumatizing. But what I'll say about that too is that the community never seemed more unified, and our cause never seemed more just than in the days and the months after that. And to this day, we seem pretty determined to see this through.
Yeah, Caleb, thank you for talking about that, because I saw the email and I read the email, but I hadn't spoken to anybody that was directly there. So I wanted to have that conversation with you to talk about it and to shine light on how dangerous this can be. I mean, our work is impactful, but there are people that don't want us to talk about stuff. So that's was exactly what happened with your staff mate's vehicle. And that is really scary. And so I'm glad that he had support there, because had he not, just imagine just going back to your car by yourself and seeing all that, like that would be really scary. So I'm glad that it helped you guys band together. It's really scary. So thank you for sharing.
And I'll just say too, that the groundswell of support we saw from people across the state and even across the nation that we've just connected with and found kindred spirits in, people who fight oil and gas and people who fight other types of contamination from the Rocky Mountains to the Pacific Ocean. It was inspiring.
Wow. Well, I'm glad everybody was there for each other, because that's really scary. And I don't mean to be like, wah, wah, before we get into our conversation, but I wanted to have that conversation and let Raphael know that I wanted everybody to know about it. We wanted to talk about it here on the show. So maybe give him that little, hey, remember Arjorie from the retreat? Well, she talked about you today. So This is a platform for all of us. Yeah. And so, you know, I'm here to talk about everybody's stuff.
Well, thank you, Arjorie.
Yeah. So, Caleb, let's get to our conversation about hydrogen.
Yeah, let's do it.
Tell the folks what hydrogen is. What is
that? All right. Oh, what a difficult question to answer. So I like to start this conversation or this type of conversation by saying there are a couple of different answers to the question, what is hydrogen? And the first one is the very basic. Hydrogen, the atom and the element, it's the first thing on the periodic table, right? It's the smallest, lightest atom there is, and it is the most abundant thing in the entire universe. You see it listed a lot as H+. Mm-hmm. Now, hydrogen is in everything from most of the massive galaxies to the thing that powers our sun to the core component in sugar and bread. It's in our bones, it's in our muscles. 10% of most human bodies is made of hydrogen atoms. So hydrogen really is the building block of the universe. Now, when we start talking about hydrogen in the context of energy and climate change and the energy transition, we're talking about something a little bit different. And that's hydrogen fuel, or H2 is the most common name you'll see for it. H2 is just what it sounds like. It's two H's stuck together. So you take a couple of those hydrogen atoms that are so abundant in the universe and you stick them together. And that forms a gas that is really light, really energy dense, and very, very combustible. It loves to burn. So when we're talking about hydrogen in terms of energy and climate change, that's generally what we're talking about.
And Caleb, is that what's called hydrogen blending?
Yeah, so hydrogen blending is basically the idea that you take a little bit of that H2, that fuel, and you blend it into another fuel supply. So like fossil gas or propane or something like that. And, you know, we can get into all the problems that can underpin doing something like that. But I think that's pretty well covered in your intro and the story about that utility company in West Eugene.
Yeah. And that's why I really wanted to talk about it with you, because it's something huge that happened. And a lot of people don't understand the science behind it. Like, no, we don't want that here. Yes, we understand it can explode, but why? You know, so I think that this conversation is important. What are some of the implications of using hydrogen or making it?
The unsatisfying answer there is it really depends on how. Now, there are a couple of ways to make hydrogen. Some are good and some are bad. And even the good can have problems. So the way that Oregon wants to make hydrogen, and the way that you can make it, you know, that doesn't have a high greenhouse gas cost to it, is through this process called electrolysis. And basically you take a bunch of water and a bunch of electricity, you mix them together, and you come out with the separate parts. So basically you take the separate parts of H2O, and you wind up with H2 and O. H2 is our fuel. Oxygen is good for all sorts of things. It's not a direct greenhouse gas. The bad way is how hydrogen has been made for the last 150 years. Basically, you take fossil fuel like fossil gas, methane, and you pull the hydrogen atoms off of that, and you let the carbon atoms just go out into the atmosphere. Most of the hydrogen on Earth right now is made that way. So making clean hydrogen is sort of a new technology, and it's sort of uncharted waters in a lot of ways. And that's where the danger lies in this transition, I think.
Caleb, is that where, when they're doing all that making of it, blending it, and doing all the things, is that what a hydrogen hub is?
Yeah, so for a lot of folks, I think they're going to be hearing the word hydrogen all of a sudden, all the time, because of hydrogen hubs. So a little bit of a flashback for folks. Last fall, I think it was, the Biden administration rolled out these things called hydrogen hubs. It's about a $7 billion initiative out of the Inflation Reduction Act. And essentially what it does is set up seven regional hubs across the United States to develop the infrastructure to make and distribute H2, hydrogen fuel. So all the plants that are going to be making it, all the pipelines that are going to transport it places, and all the depots where it's going to be stored, things like that. In the Pacific Northwest, we're expecting about $1 billion, and facilities all across Oregon, Washington, even one in Western Montana will be part of that hub. So it's a massive initiative that is coming our way like a freight train. And the trick now is to get ready for it and make sure that it's done at least as well as possible.
So you said it's coming, and that leads me to our next question here. It's coming. It's not here yet. We have to wait for these hydrogen hubs. Is that what's going on? We're not using it yet.
So we're in this weird space where H2, you know, it's almost an antiquated technology. We've been making H2 on Earth for like 150 years. You know, think all the way back to the Hindenburg and that famous broadcast, "Oh, the humanity," right? Mm-hmm. H2 was the gas that made the Hindenburg float and ultimately spurred that disaster. That's what ignited because of the poor management of that particular vessel. But at the same time, all of a sudden, we're using this ancient, antiquated technology in a very, very new way. We're going to be making it in this new way and using it for new uses, distributing it on a scale we have not even contemplated in recent decades. So, I mean, 30% of the world's greenhouse gases are prohibitively difficult to electrify. Can't make steel with electrical heat. You know, it's just not feasible. You can't use electricity as a chemical feedstock, things like that, to make the chemicals and the materials we need to be successful in the broader energy transition. We need some sort of a highly energy dense fuel. And H2 is a great option for substituting fossil gas, coal, things like that, that we really need to transition away from. So it's not a new technology, but the way that we're going to be using it is very, very new.
I liked that you used the example of the Hindenburg and, oh, the humanity and all that, because I think that a lot of the things that you're saying turn on little light bulbs for me. And I think that saying that will really have this be a conversation that people can wrap their minds around. I didn't know it was H2 that blew that thing up. I had no idea. I can see it in my mind right now. The explosion, obviously I wasn't there, but I've seen many videos of it. So I think I appreciate you saying that analogy, because I think that is an easier thing for people to sort of have an example about. So thank you for saying that and for explaining the H2 is coming. It's been here. It's not brand new, but the way that we're using it is going to be brand new. So do you know of places that are like setting up to use this? Like, is it in those hydrogen hubs that you were talking about? Are those places that are going to start using this H2 or...
So when we're talking about the Pacific Northwest Hydrogen Hub, let's just use that for our example, since that's where we're at. Mm-hmm. At least in Oregon, I know of three individual locations where the Oregon Department of Energy, or ODO, is looking at placing these hubs. And I don't think anything is completely finalized yet. We're still pretty early in the process of rolling all this out. But there was a legislative hearing over the summer where ODO's director, Janine Brenner, presented their tentative plans. And this is all a partnership between Oregon, Washington, Idaho, and Montana. So things are definitely subject to change. Mm-hmm. Having said that, the three locations in the state of Oregon that ODO is looking at for placing these electrolysis facilities where they'll be making hydrogen are Chehalis, Boardman, and Baker City. And I'll tell you what, I about jumped out of my chair when I saw Baker City. I grew up very, very close to there, and it is a very arid place. Mm-hmm. Not a lot of water to go around. And like I was saying before, if you want to make hydrogen with electrolysis, you need two things in abundance. One is electricity, clean electricity from solar farms, wind farms, hydroelectric dams, that sort of thing. The other thing is water. So making the decision to place one of these facilities in a place that doesn't have a whole lot of water is an interesting choice, shall we say.
Yeah, that doesn't really make any sense.
Yeah. And, you know, Baker City, Boardman, I know very little about Chehalis, but I can definitely speak to Baker and Boardman. They're environmental justice communities. You know, they're low-income communities with histories of contamination and contamination issues right now. The Baker Valley and the Powder River have E. coli contamination and TMDL issues in their surface water supply.
What's TMDL?
Total maximum daily load. We don't have to get super into the weeds on that. Essentially, it's the way that Department of Environmental Quality tries to limit contamination in surface waters.
Okay.
And then in Boardman, I mean, that is the very city where my friend and coworker Raphael had his pickup set on fire. It's mm-hmm. the same area that has groundwater contamination. 43% of the industrial greenhouse gas emissions in the state from large facilities are in Boardman and Hermiston, the next city down the road. So really interesting choice mm-hmm. to place these facilities in those two cities. I mean, I can see a path to that being a good thing and reducing those greenhouse gases and maybe bringing in a new water supply, piping in a new water supply to the Baker Valley. But I can also see a lot of ways that can go wrong and that this can be sort of a perpetuation of longstanding environmental injustices. Mm-hmm. These plants, you know, I've never seen a chemical plant or a power plant in an upscale neighborhood, and I don't suspect that I ever will. So
exactly. That's what I was saying. It's sacrifice zones.
Exactly. And the last thing we want is for, as we get into this energy transition and we build all this new infrastructure, the last thing we want is to perpetuate those old injustices and create new sacrifice zones or exacerbate existing ones. So mm-hmm. that there's potential for good, but it's definitely concerning.
So is that what you mean when you said H2 is an easier pill to swallow?
Yeah, you know, I think the title of the presentation I gave back in November was The Hope and the Hype. Mm-hmm. And there is definitely hope. There's also hype. Part of the hope, I think, is that hydrogen is a little bit easier for people who are skeptical of, let's say, electrification to jump on board with, right? It's a fuel. It's something that you fill a tank of. Let me just use an example. I have a friend who does mule packing in the summers. He brings his horse trailer up with a big diesel pickup to trailheads, and he packs things into the mountains for people. And these are places where there are no roads. Unless you can bring in mules or a helicopter, you're not taking anything heavy with you. So this is his livelihood, and he's very good at it. Mm-hmm. But if he were going to transition to an electric vehicle, pulling his four mules and his saddle horse, he would have a double-digit range, and he would not be able to make it to the trailhead and back. He needs some kind of a vehicle that, if it's going to be fossil-free, if it's going to be fossil fuel-free, then it can't necessarily be the electric vehicles we have on the market right now. And for him, I think a hydrogen-powered vehicle would be a much easier pill to swallow because he can fill the tank, he can have a spare tank installed on the back, he can have that long range. And I'll tell you what, there are just people out there who really love to hit that gas pedal and see that rig fly. I grew up with a lot of them. I may have been one of them at one point in my life.
You're telling on yourself.
Nobody's perfect.
No. And this is a show where you don't have to be perfect.
Good thing, because here I am.
So what are some of the concerns that your organization has. I mean, you sort of explained a little bit about where these hydrogen hubs might be and there being a sacrifice zone and all that. What are some of the concerns besides explosion and flashback? Is flashback, I'm just a side note here, is flashback what happened with the Hindenburg?
No, so the Hindenburg actually, as I understand it, it was made way too large. It was one of those things where they were trying to build the biggest, the fastest, and it's like the Olympics, the country that can build the biggest or get the most gold medals, they're the best, right? It was a German airship, and it was a combination of building it beyond what was well advised, poor maintenance. They were running it too hard for too long, and poor static management too. So with all those old blimps, they build up a lot of static moving through the air just from friction, and they don't discharge it until they touch the ground. It's like all of a sudden you touch a balloon you've rubbed on the rug and it shocks you, right?
Mm-hmm.
So same thing with the blimp. It's up there like the balloon getting rubbed by the air. And there are actually some hilarious videos of they used to have these crews, and to get the airships to land, because you can't make them any heavier once they're already up there, right? Mm-hmm. They would essentially just drop a really long rope, and there would be dozens and dozens of people down at the bottom who would just grab it. And no one wanted to be the first one to touch it because it would shock you.
Right.
So when you've got a blimp full of this highly combustible gas, though, you need to manage that static pretty well. And if that shock runs the wrong way and ignites that fuel, then you've got yourself a fireball.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cautionary tale, shall we say.
So what are some of the concerns that you all are having?
Yeah.
With this, with the hydrogen and the blending and all that, because we didn't want it to happen in West Eugene because a lot of the health implications that can happen. So I'm sorry, I didn't let you finish your thought about some of the concerns that your organization has. And do you partner with other organizations close to you, and do they have the same concerns?
We're still early enough in this process that a lot of people don't necessarily know yet that these facilities are coming. We've got some webinars and things like that coming up, but I would say one of our chief concerns is that these communities really need to be involved in deciding whether or not these facilities come in. And it doesn't really look like that's happening right now. Of course, that can change, but turning back to the core principles of environmental justice, meaningful involvement of the community in decisions that affect their lives is sort of the keystone to all that. And if that's not happening, then that is definitely a problem. Obviously, there are other concerns. You know, one of the things I like to mention to people is that hydrogen fuel, H2, it burns invisible. You can't see the flame in daylight. At night, you can see it a little bit, but it's not the traditional flame people think of, like the big orange licking flames rising up into the air. When you're burning hydrogen, you can't see the flames. And that's not something that a lot of people know, because this isn't a technology or a fuel that has really been out in the world yet. And we need to figure out how we're going to manage that and educate people about that. I like to use the example, imagine that you're a firefighter and you're responding to a crash of a freight truck, and that truck was hauling hydrogen gas. Now you get there and you see this big black plume of smoke, right? That's the paint and the seats and the plastics and electronics inside the vehicle burning. But once all that burns off and that black plume of smoke is gone, there might still be fire there because that hydrogen might still be burning, but you can't see it. And now imagine you're not a firefighter who's trained. Imagine you witness a crash and you go rushing in trying to help. Yeah. There are a lot of ways that I think hydrogen could be done very, very wrong. And making sure that our communities, one, understand all the implications of these facilities coming into their communities, and two, have a say in how that happens. Yeah. If we don't get that right, everything from there on is in trouble.
Yeah. Because the people that are trying to, they're trying to put that hub in what was it Brown Baker's? Where was it?
Baker City.
Yeah. They probably don't know, right? They
it don't sure know. Doesn't seem like it.
Yeah, they're not aware of what's happening, mm-hmm. Especially not having any water. Like, it just doesn't really rain that much over.
Oh, no, it really doesn't. And, you know, that community, it's very agriculturally oriented, and all their irrigation is dependent on snowpack, which we're getting less and less of every year. So putting additional strains on the water supply there, it doesn't seem like something that the people I know who live in Baker and love Baker would be on board for, unless there was a really good plan around it and they understood that plan. But two, it seems, I guess, like, how to word this? It seems like the same old story of these backroom deals between state agencies and industries. They come to the agreement, then the community knows about it once it's a foregone conclusion. And maybe there's a public comment period, something like that. But we need to do better than that. We need to, the energy transition is an opportunity not only to literally save the world, but also to make it better by correcting long-standing injustices, things like redlining and sacrifice zones. This transition is a chance to reverse that trend, but that's not going to happen unless it's done intentionally. And that's the role that organizations like Oregon Rural Action, Beyond Toxics, OJTA, it's up to us and the communities we work with.
It is. And I appreciate you saying that. And it's part of the things that you were saying are giving me chills. I'm thinking about there not being enough water out there, and they're trying to steal the water from the people that need it for their crops and different things. And that's ridiculous. It's the sacrifice zone, and it's exactly what was happening in West Eugene to a certain extent. Fortunately, the people in West Eugene were like, wait a second, you're going to do what? And I think the reason why they were already activated to do something like that is because of what's happened with J.H. Baxter. So in everybody's minds, it's like, okay, this is they're doing it again and again and again. And that's what happens in these low-income BIPOC areas or small rural communities like where you live. It's our job to get the word out to the community so that they can stand and be strong. I was so proud at the retreat to be able to tell everybody about the blending project that got squashed. And I think that it was powerful to be able to let everybody know that, because it was organizations like ours and the community knowing about it and putting a stop to it. People don't understand how powerful people are in numbers, especially when they're going for the same thing, the health and safety of their families and their quality of life. So when you get people together and you're talking about all those things, and you explain to them why it's dangerous, what it could be doing to their health, that's when people are activated. And it sounds like you guys are activating people out there in the rural areas. And I appreciate that, because we're not, my job is not rural. You know, I appreciate having this conversation with you, because it lets me see that there are things that happen even in smaller communities, and maybe even more in a smaller community.
It's the same story you see everywhere. People with very little economic or political power, they tend to be the ones who get trampled. So we're all in this together, and the only way that we stop these powerful interests from acting against communities' interests is by standing together.
We're dropping mics all over the place in this episode. This next thing that I'm going to talk to you about, Caleb, is not about hydrogen per se. We are going to talk a little bit about water, but we're not talking about the conversation that we had a little bit ago, because when we were talking about you being on the show, you had mentioned something about the drinking water in your community. And I'm assuming it's some of the other communities that you mentioned with the hydrogen hubs and what's going on with the water, because they're trying to take some of the water from places out there. What's going on with the water? Is it safe to drink, or what's happening?
So a lot of the work that Oregon Rural Action does day to day is organizing in an area called the Lower Umatilla Basin, which is sort of northern central Oregon. It's the northern parts of Morrow and Umatilla counties, right along the Columbia River. And it's an area that has had really well-documented levels of high nitrate in groundwater for 34 years now. Mm. And nitrate is a really nasty chemical. It's really common in fertilizers, things like that. And it's used in agriculture a lot. And one of the things that it does when it gets into the human body is it interferes with the blood's ability to carry oxygen, which is incredibly dangerous for infants, babies, also pregnant women. Over a long period of time, it can cause thyroid issues and an absolute bucket of different types of cancers. And in Boardman, again, the same town where this hydrogen hub might be going in and where Raphael's pickup was set on fire, You cannot throw a rock in that town and not hit someone who has cancer. Oh, it is heartbreaking. And we've gotten to be very close with a lot of the folks there. One of our community leaders actually just recently passed away.
I'm really sorry to hear that, Caleb.
Yeah, she was a good person. But anyway, the work we're doing there parallels a lot, I think, with stories of sacrifice zones and environmental injustices across the state, across the country, even across the world. You know, this is an area that had one of Oregon's last coal fire power plants. It has 4 natural gas power plants in the same area. Like I mentioned before, when we're talking about large industrial facilities, air pollution, 43% of the entire state of Oregon's air pollution from that type of facility is right here in the same location where this groundwater contamination is really, really run rampant. And, you know, the state of Oregon declared the area a groundwater management area back in 1990, which is before I was even born.
What does that mean?
Yeah, so a groundwater management area is set up under the Groundwater Protection Act of 1989 when high levels of contaminants are found in the groundwater. And there are 3 in Oregon: the Lower Umatilla Basin, the Malheur over in eastern Oregon, the Ontario neck of the woods, and the Southern Willamette, sort of down in that Corvallis area. All 3 are because of nitrate contamination. Now, the idea behind a groundwater management area is you convene a committee of local people to determine what steps need to be taken to reduce the contamination going into groundwater and return that groundwater to safe levels. Unfortunately, those committees have been made up of polluters. Industry is well represented on those committees, and the public is not. In fact, I'm actually on the Lower Umatilla Basin Groundwater Management Area Committee now.
Nice. But only because,
in the last couple of years, we had 2 public seats added to that committee. Before that, they were recommending nothing but voluntary actions to reduce groundwater contamination. And to be completely blunt about it, we're still outvoted by industry and agriculture, by the sectors that are doing the polluting. So it's one of those things where the action the state has taken has not been nearly enough. You know, since 1990, the data we have shows that the groundwater contamination has not even slowed. In fact, it's been getting worse. And all the while, the most frustrating thing about all of this is, even though the state took ownership of this in 1990, most people just found out that the water they were drinking was contaminated about 2 years ago.
What?
Yeah. Yeah. There was a county commissioner named Jim Doherty, Morrow County, who caught wind of this and started doing some testing of local wells and they came back very, very high. And he declared an emergency. Oregon Rural Action jumped in and started helping out with canvassing, getting well tests done. And pretty quickly, we had a couple hundred homes that could not drink the water from their faucet, but had been for years, in some cases, decades.
That's where cancer's coming from. That's where it was.
Yeah. And, you know, anecdotally, lots of stories of miscarriage, which nitrate can also cause, repeated miscarriages, heartbreaking stories. And, you know, for this to have been going on for so long and for the state to know about it and to have done so little, even to alert people to the danger, is just, it's gut-wrenching and heartbreaking and infuriating. But we've been working on that for a little over 2 years now. We've petitioned the EPA. We've gotten the governor to come visit and meet with community members. And it is a lurching, grinding start, but we have gotten a couple of things moving. There's still been no action taken to reduce the pollution, but we've gotten more wells tested, about half of them in the basin so far. And we've got people free deliveries of clean water. So
yay!
Yes,
I love that.
We love it.
Almost
500 households now either have a filter, or they are receiving as much water as they need in these big 5 gallon jugs. Now that is a band-aid of a solution, obviously, but it is so much farther than where we were a couple of years ago. And I tell you what, we're going to get some stuff done this year, and we're going to make more progress, and we're going to get further. And that community is going to get justice one way or the other.
I believe it. And you're on a board right now that's going to make it happen.
We'll see.
When you said that this has been going on since 1990 and people didn't know about it until a couple of years ago, that is like, what do you mean? Because I lived in West Eugene for most of my adult life. So I'm 50 now. I lived there for probably 25 years of my life. And I didn't know about the pollution. I didn't know what was going on in those, what was coming out of those smokestacks. You know, I just noticed them. Oh, yeah, there's some smokestacks there. Oh, I'm not thinking about what's coming out of there until my child got sick. And then I was like, wait a minute. And then I found out. And then I found out how many people don't know that live right across the street from the place. Just sinister. It's all sinister.
Yeah. So it's definitely even more sinister when you think about how in a lot of those neighborhoods, everyone has to work at that plant. That is their, that's their livelihood. That's their source of economic power and stability. So it's so hard for people to stand up against the one industry they really have to turn to put food on the table and keep a roof over their head. In the Lower Umatilla Basin, even, now let's just take Morrow County for an example, half of it. That's a county of, you know, 15, 16,000 people. Mm-hmm. And the Port of Morrow, one of our major point source polluters in the area, they employ about 6,700 people full-time year-round. Now add on to that all of the local farms that are dependent on the ports, all of the temporary, part-time, seasonal workers. It is incredibly hard for people to speak up against the port if they think they're polluting their water or any of the other polluters. It is just, there is so little economic independence or economic diversity in the area that, you know, for people to feel like if they stand up to the polluters, they won't be able to get a job. It's so easy to understand why they would just grin and bear it. And that makes it so easy to understand why this has gone on for so long with so little progress. But we're going to get that fixed.
We're going to get there, definitely, because communities stand up and they say, we're not having it.
Absolutely. And there is so much power in a unified community. There is not an industry on earth that can stand up against that.
No, there's not. And you know what? We bring people up alongside us in our organizations, and you're a hero, Caleb. So just remember that.
Oh, golly.
Caleb, thank you so much for being on the show. This has been a great chat. I'm glad that we got to get into some of the water because I think that that's important too. One of the things I want to ask you before we get on here, because we had such a heavy there towards the end, what's something you're looking forward to in 2024?
I love that. And there's so much to look forward to as well. You know, the weather's starting to get good out here in Eastern Oregon, bright sunny days. One of these days, it's not going to freeze at night and I can plant my garden. And I have got such a green thumb. I love to garden. Flowers, herbs, corn, potatoes, you name it. I cannot wait to see little seedlings coming up out of the ground.
Cute. Do you do indoor plants too?
Those I have never successfully gotten to survive. They hate me. The outdoor plants are much happier. I think they know that we're kindred spirits.
Yeah. You guys are, yeah, you're kindred spirits for sure. I can do indoor plants. And
teach me your ways.
I can't do jade though. I have tried to do jade so many times, or just succulents in general. I don't know if I'm watering them too much, if I'm not watering them enough, but I get them and they look so beautiful and green and lush. And then a couple months I'm like, it looks like I haven't even been taking care of you. So I've just given up on succulents, live succulents, and I just get fake ones that I just keep forever.
I'm going to use that.
Yeah, just use fake ones. Caleb, you're awesome. Let's keep in touch. It doesn't just have to be a podcast episode for us to talk to each other. We have each other's phone numbers, emails. I'm going to be checking on what's going on with that water and just what's going on in general in your neck of the woods, because, you know, we're connected as organizations. So thank you.
Absolutely. And thank you so much, Arjo. You are like one of the most awesome people I've ever met. I could not, if I had all the time from now to the heat death of the universe, I could not heap enough praise on you. You're just an excellent person. So thank you for all that you do and for putting up with me today. And yes, let's keep in touch. I can't wait to hear all about what you and all the good folks you work with are up to in the next year.
Thanks, Caleb. Caleb, thank you so much for being on the show. It was really awesome chat. And I just want to make sure that everybody knows that you can reach me at aab@beyondtoxics.org. You can chit chat with me anytime, and I would love to hear from you. Caleb, how can we get in touch with you? How can these folks find out where you are?
Thank you so much for having me today, Arjory. This was so much fun, and you're just such a wonderful person. I'm more than happy to take questions from anyone. My email is kalebl@oregonrural.org.
Excellent. Thank you for listening to the show today and or reading the show, because we're also transcribed. So if you're having any hearing problems, you can read about what we talked about today. I'll catch up with you next time. Bye-bye.